That would benefit you. Your tendency toward the defensive has made you highly dangerous beings. But then, how can we know who comes in peace and who no? It so happens that those who could help you, cannot approach you, and still cannot. You must grow in knowledge and augment your receptive capacity, modify your habits. I already knew that she, Lia, had a solid basis for speaking thus. Her experience was very great, but at times her words confused me, and later not even I myself knew how to explain her. I sunk into reflection, even after thinking scarcely a few seconds on what she had said, and I asked, "Well, and God? Where is he? Does he exist in truth?" She looked into space and sighed profoundly, perhaps in search of adequate words to define the great portent of nature. To explain to me in a detailed manner, who was or is God. "Listen, Professor, in the chronicles of your world there appeared beings who could fly, overcoming the attraction of gravity. In one of these histories there appeared two civilizations simultaneously visiting your planet. One overcame gravity in a manner different from the other. The first flew from one place to another, and could proceed with ease, wherever they wanted. Their magnetic field permitted this, but that field was not visible to the others. The others still did not possess the secret of negativizing of light in the magnetic field, for which these shone and were visible. In time many adopted this knowledge and began to utilize magnetic fields of energy to repel the gravity of your world upon arriving and descending to the surface of your planet. Those beings who floated and shone with a radiance, much surprised many of those inhabitants of almost 5,000 Earth years ago, or between 300 and 400 of our cycles back. Your surprise increased when I told you of the capacity they had to displace themselves to another place, and above all the ship in which the ETs traveled, produced much fear in the inhabitants. The inhabitants at the time knew of nothing similar. For them, all of this was divine. These then came to consider us gods coming to Earth. But those were like us, and we have nothing exceptional except our scientific advances. Those who show decadence in their sentiments and their acts, can lose many rights of interstellar level. We cannot lie nor can we destroy, for which many of us know and aid each other in space. They came to your world with the intention of informing all who would be able to understand of the inhabitants of Earth. But many obstacles developed between the ETs and the Earth humans. The humans did not comprehend that there were other inhabited worlds like yours. They were controlled by one criteria unified under one chief, in such a way that the chief imposed his ideas on all the others and they accepted it or saw themselves obliged to do so. The terrestrials only interpreted one cycle and one Earth, and they believed that those extraterrestrial beings were gods whose powers were superior to all they had seen before then. Because of their manner of dress, the terrestrials could not decide whether the ETs were men or women or both. They deified them to the point of fanaticism. There were such diverse, and so many, interpretations that the humans formed separate groups, and there still exist confrontations between entire societies over these ideas. Each city adopted their own interpretation according to their own taste and their own histories, after which they became mythified. And finally they became so distorted, that even we could not understand what had been recorded on the rocks. Your scientific terminology has not reached those specific levels that convey the greater knowledge, and for that you do not comprehend absolutely all that I explain to you, and this derives toward uncertain points, praising them to these apparitions which were taking forms in ever-increasing locales, to the end that they became identified with the society in question. The subsequent generations did not understand much of it and began to ask questions. And the teachers of yesteryear were not showing the point exactly correct. 1. Those who came from other worlds wanted to explain who God exactly was. But before that, they needed to inform that they themselves came from other worlds and were extraterrestrials, and that others possessed the same genetic makeup, shape, DNA, etc., as yourselves. Their anthropomorphic form did not convince the terrestrial inhabitants that they were human. They knew that they had seen a being descend from the sky, and they would never admit the contrary. The event was considered so extraordinary that it was engraved on rocks for posterity, but they did this in accordance with their knowledge and mentality. In those times the people of your world did not exactly understand this extraterrestrial phenomena, and that explains, in part, much of the falsehood encountered in your monoliths. But if it was difficult then to make the inhabitants of your planet understand our extraterrestrial origin, it is not easy now to make them understand that many of those apparitions that they saw did not pertain directly to the nature of God. Those who came to your world were only informants or investigators, who studied and analyzed the future of your world and its comportment. The facts occurring were involving the terrestrials in a labyrinth that more than historical, was mythical, disquieting those minds and intruding upon the feelings. The people were afraid, and this made it easy for them to be controlled by those outcomes of the kings, chiefs, directors and leaders. Though in some manner the idea was not lost, the message was diverted into obscurity, and being changed in substance between one translation and another. Those who did not understand, rejected it or relegated it for later analysis, losing many times, thus, important information. This also influenced the grade of knowledge of each society, because in some manner this contributed to the ever greater retardation of the advance of man. In truth, we never could understand why you did not understand the message in the correct form, for at least that of the origin of the civilizations that visited your planet. And today we fear that you will yield to the same. We are all of us, you and all the other inhabitants of the universe, the excellent creation of an infinite being. Most powerful. God exists, of course, Lia said in a most reverent way, and for us it is the most powerful bioelectrical magnetic force, which controls all vibrational movement of a passive state, an active state and vice versa. Then God is both life and death? That which you call death is the vibrational state in repose. Effectively, the great bioenergetic force of God creates and absorbs, ebbs and flows. It is an inexhaustible source of knowledge, whose power is only perceivable to you through matter, for which you know it superficially and at times unjustly. In truth there exist hundreds of forms of life, one of which is energy in its most pure manifestation. These bodies are uniquely energy vibratory. 3 To us they are invisible entities or beings, bodies like magnets that attract structures of their same species. They can conduct themselves throughout the whole universe. And that scarcely would be the tiniest example of which could serve as a concept to show you what God is. An invisible body can absorb another? Not precisely. On that point there is no intent for dominion of one entity over another. Those bodies attract those with which they associate, but they don't annihilate them. They also possess a powerful repellent force, and can transit incalculable spaces and can be here now and on another world in form simultaneously. Yes. Actually their power is immense, but God is above all that, which you cannot comprehend. God cannot be understood through threats, nor through fears. God has given life, and life has a force, a cycle, depending on the force with which it has been created. Nobody in the universe has the right to take it, life, except for his own survival. For even before some injustice in the ultimate moment, you must not kill. All in space carries a continuous state of harmony. To alter it costs much to whoever tries. God is above all living forms that swarm in the universe, and I can tell you that matter, as you know, is the manifestation of the most primitive of its power. God is not ruled by time nor space. Time and gravity are inseparable. If we measure something, and it has weight, we can evaluate its gravity, then we can know that it exists. God exists though we cannot measure its knowledge, its weight, nor its capacity. We also search the beginnings of our science thousands of cycles after our own origin. We initiated our investigation of our genetic conformation and its formula from beginning to end, but the most interesting was the DNA molecular system, as you would call it, and to learn that we could reprogram all of an existence in a manner such that this could produce a race of genius, which could adequately receive universal information of an interstellar level. 5. I don't understand this well, I said sincerely. For example, your primitive DNA suffers no alterations, for which the human can live through one cycle of regeneration, though it is limited. There are no changes in the love, nor hate, intervening to reduce the energy. There is no reformation of your structure. You can reprogram yourselves in a manner, according to your mental, or intellectual, capacity, supposing that you have no limits, replacing old concepts with new, or those knowledges can improve your perceptions, both mental, visual, auditive, etc. This is the way you want to really improve the genetic time of man through his DNA. And have you had success in these experiments on your planet? That was in the beginning when we inquired much into the existence of the being as a living entity and, above all, the origin of God. Today, for us, this is so old that it is genetico-scientific history. On our planets they developed great changes and improved our races, by reprogramming the genes without genetic deformation. It has cost much. But today that is possible, and there still are scientists who are occupied with this on other planets. The measure of such knowledge expands and they strive to know more and more, and then they disseminate this to the greater races, always alert to the maintaining of communication with the objective of retransmitting the results obtained. Thus it was that they came to know also new worlds, and as such they made the gift of life to those which they found insufficient development and with resources necessary for intelligent survival. The rule in interstellar society is to eradicate the degenerative instincts and raise man to a superior level, each time better than before. Our mission comes to be that of teachers, who also begin from zero like all of you, with the difference that on your planet you cannot duly obtain the knowledge, because the scientists unfortunately die, and with each generation some of the relative initial knowledge is lost. Notes 1. It has been pointed out by other extraterrestrial visitors that one of our greatest losses of knowledge in the past has been through the inability of the teacher to pass on all he knows to his pupil because of the very short lifespans of Earth humans. By the time the pupil starts to catch up, he is already advanced in age himself and cannot pass on all he knows to his pupil. Thus, generation by generation, great original truths are corrupted and lost. 2. A rock painting on the wall of a very ancient cave near Fergana in Uzbekistan shows a space-suited figure with an atmospheric helmet on his head waving goodbye, or greeting, to a disc-shaped ship rising, or descending, on an efflux of light flowing down in a vertical column from the underside of the craft. A human in primitive dress squats to the right of the suited figure watching the same event. The drawing was estimated to be 7,000 years old. See The Gods from Outer Space, by Eric von Daniken. 3. The reference here is to higher forms of life which are pure energy and are not manifested in matter, thus totally beyond our perception. 4. The one thing sacred above all other things is life, and the termination of any living being is a serious violation of nature that is never without consequence. 5. Remarkably, many of the extraterrestrial abductions for biogenetic experiment include references to purification or adjustment of the genes, which are made up of DNA, before the controlled cross-fertilization was allowed to take place. The implied objective of this process was to remove inherited imperfections and malmutations. Part 12, from Chapter 28, Life and Death of Planets. Translated from notes made in November 1975. The discussion mentioned in the previous chapter continues, and Professor Hernandez asks another question of the extraterrestrial woman Lia. Do we die the same as on all the other planets? No. She said flatly. All the inhabited planets live from a star which supplies them with energy. The life depends upon the nearness or farness of the solar rays, travel. I shall explain. The solar energy stimulates the molecules, but there always must exist a vibratory level of conductivity. The majority of the planets near a star in movement suffer from it, but some balance the movements perfectly, avoiding much of the frictions of energy. Of course they are not worlds like yours. But, nevertheless, with the help of other technologies, including contributions from other civilizations, they come to preserve life on those planets. There are planets whose atmospheres are so delicate that they completely lack density on their surface, which, at simple sight, appears to be swirls of sand dunes. Logically, there could exist no life as you know it, but I know there is some type of life, different. In ordinary stars they detect from 40 million to 1 billion degrees centigrade, sick. Others like the sun, which feeds your world, generate 20 million and in their center almost 60 million, sick. The intensity of energy thus would reach any other planet sufficiently near. Another planet, before Mercury, that approached its, the sun's, surface crystallized and was absorbed by the potent energy of the sun of your system. We are all made of stellar material. You will encounter the remains of rocks in every part of this universe, which contain amino acids similar to those of your organism. All, starting from the same, chemical, components that you know, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, silicon, etc., are concentrated, confined, and coordinated by the DNA. Do you imagine? It is beautiful to think that in space the bodies vibrate in the same manner as the atoms of our body? That is life, and its complexity shows us the power of God. Observe the development of your species. Each one of those animals that live on your world have some particularity. And that is programmed in the DNZ of each being. Each one reproduces according to its genus without change, without alterations, until it comes to new knowledge and takes a new step. If God concedes to those civilizations a contribution of knowledge, to beings who can control that without danger for the universe. Returning to the theme of death, I can tell you that at one time the earth was much closer to the sun, as also Rampart told in his books R.O.M. It then provoked an exuberant flora and fauna that grew by gigantic steps. When the solar radiation increased, man aged prematurely. Why? It happened that the dead cells were accelerated in the process of putrefaction with the molecular overstimulation, but the live organism worked intensely, which produced a premature senility. On other worlds, where adequate solar energy is available, and where it lives conveniently removed from the nourishing star, the inhabitants reach ages that would surprise you. The process of aging is slow, there, because there is no molecular overstimulation. The moon of your world also causes an excessive expense of energy by the human being. The moon causes an excessive expense of energy, as a body in the process of extinction, it tries to available. In the beginning the Earth had no satellite. It was conditioned to this, for which through the absorption of a little discharged energy, was provoked of great quantities of solar energy to your world. The moon serves as a sponge to compensate for the overcharge, but it also is a powerful marking point for the Earth, which had lost orbital force after the hecatomb that occurred on your world. From Chapter 29, Danger to Cities. Translated from notes made in November 1975, further continuing the discussion described in chapters 27 and 28, Liar describes a new danger for our great cities as a result of our crowded populations and our lack of control of the industrial technologies. Nevertheless, the Earth human must take care of himself because the heat will asphyxiate the great cities who have a large thermic surface for the accumulation of noxious gases. This also is a danger. The condensation of said gases could come in a moment. On other worlds of equal terms of civilization to yours, they remove or they neutralize all kinds of poisonous gases. That's it, Liar. One theme aggregates another, until it seems that you want to wrap me in a halo of wisdom for intensive knowledge, as if the time was about to terminate before I know it. How difficult it is to understand all that you have invited to meditate upon. That frequently was too much for me. Many times I was left without absorbing the flow of her wisdom teachings. Liar was the teacher and I the smallest of her students. I also felt it hopeless to try to correspond in her discussions. I wanted to show her that I understood all that she said, but I did not want to seem false. She knew to what measure I assimilated all that she said. She could not allow falsehood and I must not fake my position. Chapter 30. Various spacecraft used. In the course of clearing up details for the publisher of this report, when Del Stevens had written to Sther inquiring about more details on the Andromedan spacecraft, that may have been taken down in the hundreds of pages of shorthand, during the discussions with Professor Hernandez, she had confessed to an ignorance of some of the more technical elements of those discussions, and was more interested in the dialogues she better understood. Those were the substance of the first pages on transcribed shorthand notes she sent for examination, and they make up the first 21 chapters of this report. Xtha's description of how she selected the material she sent and her problems in deciding what to deal with next are very illuminating, and are important in understanding how much the real story has been downplayed in its transmission to us for this report. She offers her idea on the possible confusion of our Andromeda constellation only a few hundred light-years distant with the Andromeda galaxy over 800,000 light-years distant, by conservative estimates. After Stephen's inquiries, she had checked with a local astronomer who also agrees that the Andromedan planet Inkstria has to be in the Andromeda constellation in our own galaxy. She logically suggests that some confusion may have come in, due to the professor's possible lack of astronomical knowledge, and an unconscious association of the galaxy with the word Andromeda. She goes on to describe exactly what her awareness of the Palladian contacts in Switzerland was, and where her information came from and when, and believes that the professor did not know even this much, thus reducing the potential for feedback from the Swiss case. And then she discovers some untranscribed dialogue on another class of Andromedan ship of intermediate size and clear mention of an even bigger mother ship. These new revelations coming at this time are of such importance that this letter becomes a document of itself in this highly unusual report, and so we shall translate it here in its entirety for your examination. Perhaps the most astounding revelation of this letter is the overwhelming inflow of information now flooding the professor. He is being picked up more frequently and is being taken to various places to witness things of such import so often, that he gives up setting down the details in his diary. In fact, he gives up even keeping a diary of his activities, and now the information simply flows from his recollections in such torrents that Xtha is no longer able to get it all down, and so her shorthand notes are unable to keep up with the history. She ends up with long monographs on a given subject expounded on by the professor, which then easily jumps to another subject with no transition between them. The professor's almost casual mention of the considerable variety of special-purpose spacecraft used is such a case. He has been in small two-person craft, five-person ships and other small ones. Then he has been taken to intermediate-size craft, that would be considered very large by us, which carry many occupants plus some of the smaller-sized craft. He has also been taken out to a great mother ship of immense size, which carries a number of intermediate and many smaller ships inside of it. To stop and describe all of these phenomenal vehicles in detail, simply entails too much time and energy, which he did not feel he had to spare, and so he passes over much of this kind of information in his discussions of other things, which he considered the more important, such as the philosophical information and the messages these extraterrestrials had for Earth humanity. A point came where the professor no longer set anything down in writing, and as he remembered something to be added to another thing already described to Xtha, he would call her up and fill in the additional details that might have been overlooked before. Thus the shorthand notes became broken bits of information, disconnected and sometimes scattered, such that their true relationship to the whole was not always clear. Here is Xtha's letter, which partly begins to explain this situation. It is a real tragedy that it was simply impossible to take down all the information that was available through the professor before he disappeared. From Chapter 31, The Professor's Disappearance. Playing the Devil's Advocate. Wendell Stevens wrote Xtha Rodriguez in Mexico City and raised all the doubts other advisors had mentioned to him concerning this very mysterious case. There was the disappearance of the principal and probably only witness to the actual contacts. There was the disappearance of most of his hundreds of pages of notes and diary entries. There was the apparent hostility of the professor's wife, who indicated no willingness at all to cooperate or to again produce the professor's papers returned to her by Xtha Rodriguez. There was the unwillingness to allow any interviews with the professor's children who might have been able to contribute something to the investigation. There was the lack of professional colleagues and even personal friends with whom the professor might have shared his confidence, because he himself, after first attempts, had come to fear their reactions to such a story. This did not make for much tangible support for a case like this, and Stevens expressed a desire to renew the investigation with better resources and try to collect some real substantial evidence. He He had interested some backers in supporting such an effort to discover more tangible evidence and had given Sir Rodriguez a list of things to try to set up for reinvestigation when he could bring a team of researchers to Mexico City. Sther was trying to do this as best she could, facing great difficulty in trying to reopen the case. Apparently some Mexican government investigators had entered the scene and were trying to frustrate any other effort besides their own. She learned that the professor's wife herself was under suspicion in the disappearance of the professor, and that police detectives had been unable to close the case for lack of a body. The straightforwardness of Sther's reply and the poignancy of her interview with Sra. Rodriguez are so revealing that we have decided to publish that whole letter here for you to read for yourself. Translation, Mexico, D.F. the 17th of April of 1988, Mr. Wendell C. Stevens 47475, ASFCD, Healer Unit South E14, P0 Box 5003 Douglas, Arizona 85608. Dear Mr. Wendell, excuse my tardiness in answering, but motivated by your doubts that you amiably made me understand in your last letter, I decided with all the possible risks to interview Sra. Fernandez. But I had to think of a way to do it. I believed that she must have more information. And I was not mistaken. I looked in truth for the manner of interviewing her in the best way, as to say, without injuring her sensitivities, since she is a person really difficult to deal with. I shall not go into details about how I did it. It was not easy because Sra. Hernandez has passed through a series of very difficult situations. She never conducted herself with me in any courteous manner whatsoever. At first, she argued that she did not want to have any contact with journalists, and let me tell you, Mr. Wendell, that after having listened attentively, I understood perfectly her situation and her attitude. One of the first questions I asked was, "Where is the professor?" She pursed her lips and remained silent for a moment, and then she began to cry and said to me that she did not know. She answered me saying that actually she had investigated his mysterious disappearance, which occurred on the 2nd of February 1984, and that many of the writings that were left by the professor are in the hands of, since that date, some investigators that are studying the case. She believes that in some of the many writings there is information or some fact about the professor. But up to now she has been able to learn absolutely nothing of him. Sra. Hernandez told me that she has carried on investigation in the most discreet manner possible, and that she has no desire to allow publicity of the case. Unfortunately, neither she, nor her children, nor those who have investigated the case, believe in the existence of extraterrestrial beings, and I say unfortunately, because in reality, to me, after analyzing the circumstances that surround his disappearance, it makes it much easier for me to believe that he left with his extraterrestrial friends. If the professor had written something in those last days, or even only one day before his disappearance, the investigators could have discovered it, but I have not had access to those writings, and the little that the wife of the professor has in her hands will be made available to me after she returns from a trip she is going to make to Cuautla. They lived in Cuautla when he disappeared. Link to map over Cuautla, Mexico. I asked the Sra., why have you told me absolutely nothing about the disappearance of the professor, and said that she did not want to involve me in the investigations? Moreover, the detectives had told her not to speak to anybody about the affair as they feared it would thwart the investigations, because they always believed they were dealing with a crime though they had not found the body. She affirmed that the first time that the professor had been interned in a hospital was in 1982 and that he remained there because he had a very serious burn on one knee. She said she couldn't remember well whether it was the left side. Though this burn was very strong, to the surprise of the doctors, it healed much more rapidly than normal considering the age of the professor. What really happened was that the treatment was prolonged nevertheless, and that was when they asked him how he had burned it, and he, quite simply, said that he had been about to descend from an extraterrestrial ship. This surprised me, Mr. Wendell, because he always wanted to keep his secret at all costs. Why did he say that? Only he knew about it. From there they sent him to the psychiatric clinic for all kinds of analysis to understand his state of mental health and to determine what it was that was making him mention UFOs and extraterrestrial beings.